On this episode of Skeptico, author of Authors of the Impossible, Dr. Jeff Kripal.
I have no desire to return to a religious worldview that is essentially dysfunctional now. I'm thinking more of creating a new religious worldview, not me personally, mind you, but as a culture. When religious systems start out, nobody knows where they're going, and they never, ever, ever come out of nowhere. They're always syntheses or fusions of the scientific knowledge of the time and the different cultures that are interacting. And so, you know, where I place my hope isn't on Church A or Synagogue B or Scientist X. It's the future generations who can put this stuff together in a completely new way.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and I have a very interesting interview coming up today with Dr. Jeff Kripal. Now, what the Skeptico show has always been about is using science, the scientific method, logic, and reason to nudge a little bit closer to the truth. And what is interesting about this episode today is we're going to expand that and loosen up that definition a little bit and consider whether or not straight empiricism, empirical data, is the only way to get to truth. And I think you may have a sense of where I'm going with this a little bit from the last few episodes, but let me spell it out to you a little bit further based on this very interesting YouTube video I came across. So I was just kind of cruising through YouTube, and I came across this.
Every spiritual person claims what they are teaching is the true knowledge. There should be a scale for truth. What is truth? There should be definition. There should be clear idea with which we can find out whether it is truth or not.
Now, this gentleman's name is Swami Nithyananda, and he's an Indian yogi and Hindu adept with hundreds of thousands of devotees around the world. At least that's what we learned from his website. Now, the first thing that struck me about his video was the presentation. One, this guy looks like a Bollywood actor, right out of central casting for Indian Swami. I mean, he's good looking, looks like an Indian movie star, long black hair, all the robes, and a big banner of him in the background with his smiling face on it. So it looked very, very commercial. But I was also intrigued by his message. He was reinforcing a lot of the things that I've learned over the years about the yoga tradition and the Hindu tradition. So there were these two kind of competing thoughts going on in my head when I went to Google News and Googled him. And what do you think I found? Well, he's embroiled in a sex scandal. He was caught on videotape in a very compromising position with a Bollywood actress. And since then, there's been reports that he's had similar such affairs with 40 or 50 of his devotees. He spent 50 days in jail and is out on bond waiting for trial. So what are we to make of all that? I think there's four basic ways that you can process this story up to this point in an effort to come to the truth about the situation, because that's what we're really talking about today. So position number one, I'm going to call the saint. And this is the official position that his followers have taken. And that's that this is all a misunderstanding. People are out to get him. They've morphed the video. They've altered the video. It's somehow the evidence isn't what it seems to be. So the saint. The second position I think you could take is what I'd call the fallen saint. Yes, this person really is, or at least was, a spiritual master, but is somehow fallen victim to the human frailties that we all have, and maybe some of this stuff is true, but he still is this spiritual adept. The third position I think one could take is what I'm going to call the spiritual scammer. And that would be to say, you know, there probably really are spiritually adept folks who have a greater knowledge of spiritual things, but this guy isn't one of them, and he's just a scammer. And the fourth and final position I think you could take is just what I'd call the scammer. And that is to say, there are no spiritual truths. There is no higher consciousness. All religions at their core are fantasy, religion is a virus kind of school. So I think when you break things down in that way into those four groups, you can immediately see some of the problems in getting at the truth. I mean, depending on your cultural background, your education background, and mostly your experience, you probably think one of those situations is more true than the other, given the facts that we have in this case. And we have to acknowledge that we don't know. I wasn't there. I don't have all the facts. And I just read a couple of newspaper accounts. But that doesn't matter. I think the situation is the same, whether we're talking about Swami Nithyananda or whether we're talking about near-death experience or Sai. It's the same. We have a certain set of facts. We have a certain set of preconceived ideas that are influenced and are changing all the time by our culture, by new information that we get, and by our experiences. And we wind up taking these positions that can really polarize us from other folks that we might want to share with. So in this case, if you consider the folks who consider the Swami to be a saint and to still be a saint, you can imagine the problems that they would have dialoguing with the folks who think he's purely a scammer. Moreover, even the folks who think he's a fallen saint might have a lot of problems dialoguing with the folks that fall into this spiritual scammer group. So what is the truth? And how do we, as Swami Nithyananda points out, how do we define and measure the truth? It's a good question. I don't know that I can get there by following him, but it is a good question. And how can we go about that search with the humility that comes from understanding that the truth we know, even the truth that we experience, is layered with all those biases and prejudices and cultural influences that we rarely want to look at? Well, these are some of the topics that I had the great pleasure of dialoguing with Dr. Jeff Kripal about. As you'll hear in this interview, Dr. Kripal goes way beyond being well qualified in religious and literary studies. He's really a broad thinker about a number of these topics relating to consciousness and the future of science and spirituality. Stay with me for this interview with Dr. Jeff Kripal. Today we're joined by the author of Authors of the Impossible, The Paranormal and the Sacred, a book that he's also developing into a documentary film, as well as a podcast titled Impossible Talk. And as an aside, I have to mention what a fine podcast it is. The interviews are just fantastic, and Jeff brings this dialogue between colleagues style that's really enjoyable and quite insightful. He's also the head of the Department of Religious Studies at Rice University, and is the author of several other interesting books I hope we have a chance to talk about. Dr. Jeff Kripal, thanks for joining me today on Skeptico.
Hey, thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, you bet. I mean, you know, Jeff, it's kind of interesting digging into your background here. I mean, Department of Religious Studies at Rice University. That doesn't sound all that exciting on the surface, but what a story. I mean, you grow up Roman Catholic, you go to the seminary for 4 years because you think you want to be a priest, you leave, get this PhD from University of Chicago in Comparative Religions, and then wind up writing a book, Kaylee's Child, about homoerotic interpretations of this Hindu saint, and you find yourself in this just intellectual firestorm, and your book is being debated on the floor of the Indian Parliament. And now here you are 15 years later, and you're tackling Sai and the paranormal. I mean, what a ride for an academic.
Yeah, no, it's been a ride. And it's all related in my mind. It's all really the same set of questions, but it, from the outside, it might look pretty wild.
Tell us a little bit about that path, and what are those questions?
Well, it's a long story. I've told it in many places. I can give you the short version. The short version is I started out in a Benedictine monastic seminary, really wanting to be a monk, not a priest. Priests work too hard. That looked like way too much work to me.
Right.
I was more interested in the sort of contemplative scholarly life of a monastic community, and was trained by just some fantastic monks in Missouri, and really got turned on to philosophy and historical criticism and the study of religion and psychoanalysis, which in some sense I had to get interested in because I was deeply, deeply anorexic and basically dying on some level. And so the monks put me into psychoanalysis with one of their own monks, and it was a very powerful experience and essentially cured me of the anorexia, but in the process taught me that religious behaviors and religious institutions, and particularly profound religious experiences, are all deeply connected to sexuality and to erotic energies. And so that was really it really was an initiation by fire, and on both levels there, I guess. And it was a kind of survival for me. I was fighting for my life. And so that really got me interested in this connection between spirit and sex, if you want to define the binary that way. And that's what took me to India to study tantric traditions in Bengal, and then in my second and third books, looking at erotic mystical literature in both the West and in Asia. And I think that's really the deeper root here. I've always argued fairly passionately, some people would say too passionately, that spirit and sex are two sides of the same thing. And with my present work on the paranormal, I'm essentially making the exact same argument with respect to mind and matter. I'm basically trying to, you know, take apart these binaries or these dualities that we're always imagining the world to be.
But in fact,
it's not.
Yeah, and if I can pull that apart a little bit and maybe pull the sexual part out of it for just a minute, because the other thing you draw out that would be interesting to our audience is the different ways of looking at things from the standpoint of what the humanities bring and what this
right.
narrative brings versus what the empirical science brings. And I think you also make that connection too between, you know, we can only approach the spiritual from this other poetry plus rather than science minus kind of approach. And then what's
right.
interesting, I think, to our listeners especially is then you draw that same parallel with psi and with the paranormal and say, hey, maybe the reason why we're not getting closer to it with science is because it needs that same poetry plus angle to it.
Right. I mean, basically the argument I make in the author's book is that if you look at how we've divided up our knowledge systems in the modern world, you know, really since Descartes, we've split the world in half. And we've split it into matter and mind. And matter is the object, literally the object of the scientific method. And science has taken that method very, very far and given us incredible things, one thing after the other. But it's failed really completely to explain consciousness. And the reason it's failed is because consciousness is not an object. It's the subject doing the science. And so science is not adequately equipped to study consciousness, because it's assuming that everything is an object, everything's made of matter, everything can be replicated and quantified in a controlled laboratory, and it simply can't be. And so the humanities, then, this sort of this broad range of fields that I inhabit, our whole subject is in fact the subject. It's the nature of consciousness as it gets encoded in culture and language and literature and religion and philosophy. And we've developed all these methods for hundreds of years to study consciousness. And so really all, what I'm saying on the most basic level in the book, Authors of the Impossible, is that folks, maybe the humanities have something to offer this conversation. It doesn't mean we stop doing laboratory parapsychology, but it means if we really want to understand experiences that seem to violate completely this division between subject and object, maybe we better listen to some disciplines and some people who know all about how to talk about the subject and consciousness. It's a humble argument on one level.
Uh-huh. Well, I think a lot of some humility is is needed, you know, on both the spiritual side when they talk about what they know, and on the scientific side when they talk about what they know. So I think there's plenty of room for humility. And, you know, to bring it down to a concrete example that you gave, I think I was listening to one of your podcasts and you said this, and it really struck me because it's a nice concrete example. And you said, you know, let's say you had the question and someone asked the question, you know, hey, why is God usually portrayed as a male figure? You know, in many religious traditions. Well, how do you can't get there scientifically. I mean, that's a classic case where you need a lit review and you need some other means. Do you want to expound on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, let me give you a really simple example that I think works better than the male God question. The way I define the humanities and the sciences very simply, but I think it helps, is the sciences are a set of methods that assume that the world is made of numbers and matter. The humanities are a set of disciplines that assumes that the world is also made of words and stories. And I think if you just define those two fields of knowing that way, then you can understand. Then you take somebody's paranormal experience, take something very simple like a synchronicity. Like take Jung's famous story of working with a female patient about the scarab beetle, this dream. This woman has this dream of the scarab beetle, and as she's telling him this dream, this scarab beetle or this insect is knocking on the window, and Jung opens the window, and a beetle flies in, he catches it in his hand, he says, "Here's your dream." And that was the key point that dissolved her sort of hard rationalism and her worldview. Now, what a humanist does is look at that and says, well, that event was not structured by causality and necessarily material processes. It's working exactly as if it were a story, and it needs symbols or signs to work at all. In other words, you need to know something about the scarab beetle. You need to know something about a dream in ancient Egypt, and then you need to interpret this beetle coming in the window as fitting into that dream story. So there are all of these processes going on within a synchronicity that are textual. They're basically narrative processes that have nothing to do with causality. They have everything to do with story and plot and symbol and sign. And I think a lot of people's paranormal experiences are powerful precisely to the extent they're about story and meaning and have really very little to do with material causal processes. And so that's the contribution, I think, there.
Right. And I've heard you make that point before. And I have to say, every time I hear it, I get close to it, but you haven't really won me all the way over. And I the scientific side of me wants to kind of pull it down and say, okay, but let's get down to specifics. I mean, let's look at something I'm interested in, continuation of consciousness. And I know you're interested in it too, and I've heard you speak about it. So what prevents us from getting closer to that through science? What are we missing if we approach this topic head on with the current kind of research methods that we're using, for example, into near-death experience? Why can't we get there with regular science?
Well, nothing should stop us from doing that. I'm all for science. I'm all for laboratory parapsychology and near-death research. I think they're fantastic.
Right. I'm not saying you're not. I'm just saying you seem to be suggesting that there's something that we can't quite get there.
Well, because at the end of the day, consciousness is not an object. You will never, ever, ever be able to measure it or to see it on a screen because it's an interior mind reality. It's not an object in space and time. I suppose that's my basic assumption.
Right, but we have all sorts of means of measuring the effects of...
Yeah, we can measure the effects of mind. We can measure correlations in brain states, but nobody can get consciousness on the screen. And all of these pretty pictures we're always seeing in neuroscience textbooks or TV programs, they give the illusion that we're actually seeing something direct, but we're not. We're seeing something indirect there. We're seeing brain states. We're not seeing the actual mental state.
Right, but see, that seems to me to be more something that we can unravel. I mean, there's a question that I think we can get closer to scientifically, and that's
I agree.
Do brain states correlate to mind states? And I think that answer has really already been given.
Absolutely. I'm just a little guy. Alex, I'm just a little humanist in the room of scientists raising my hand in the corner saying, hey, guys and gals, maybe I could just speak once in a while. You know, maybe we have something to offer the conversation. And maybe if you actually look at how near-death experiences are reported and when they take place, we can come up with patterns and we can make very educated guesses about how these are induced and in what context they tend to happen. So, for example, take a near-death experience. If you read the literature on near-death experiences, what you are essentially reading are thousands and thousands of stories. So there, you already have a set of narratives. And these things tend to take place only in highly traumatic or tragic situations. It looks to me like you need some kind of trauma to have one of these. But you couldn't conclude that until after you've read hundreds and thousands of what are essentially stories, and then classified them and drawn comparisons, and then finally patterns and some kind of tentative conclusion. So those are the methods of the humanities. That's what the humanities do. They read story after story and come up with patterns and tentative conclusions. But we never prove anything.
Right, but those are also the methods of many of the fields of social science, right? I mean, so sociologists do that, psychologists do that, anthropologists do that in a different way. But, you know, so it's not confined to the humanities. And I guess that No. gets me to the other thing that keeps cropping up when I hear this stuff is, you know, the track record of humanities and really in its interplay with science hasn't always been so great. And one thing that popped out from your work is the whole psychoanalysis. And because it's kind of a hot button for me and kind of a litmus test for me, you know, how do you process Freud? I mean, here's a guy who seems to crop up in your work and I just can't quite get my arms around it. I mean, if we knew then what we know now about Freud, I mean, in terms of fabricating cases and gross, you know, academic dishonesty, I mean, he wouldn't be a forgotten man. He'd be like worse than a forgotten man. And yet, especially in the statistics, just in terms of references to Freud across all the disciplines at the university, you know, the humanities keep referencing Freud and everyone else has kind of forgotten about him. How do you unpack that whole thing?
Well, I don't think Freud was actually doing science. I think he was basically a grand interpreter, and he was approaching mental states as texts and dreams as stories that had to be unwound and decoded with what were basically literary methods. And so I think that's why he has such a happy home in the humanities, and it's because we see him as a very skilled reader of texts and a very suspicious reader of texts. He didn't, you know, Freud's gift to us is to not read texts on the surface, is to see them as coded and as hiding something, and to try to find out which is hidden. So I, you know, I understand that classical psychoanalysis is, you know, more or less considered witchcraft in academic psychology today. But I think this is just a treasure house of insight in Freud. And you have to remember, personally, the man cured me, saved my life. So I have a hard time throwing him out.
Yeah, that's so interesting on so many different levels. I mean, here's that line that we walk. I mean, we have to acknowledge that, as you're kind of suggesting with the narrative thing, that the truth is relative and we all kind of come at our own truth, you know, for personal experience. But in terms of science and in terms of truth, which is also relative, don't we have come to some consensus about what are proper methods and what is self-promoting bullcrap? I'll give you another example that's more tied to the psi stuff that we're talking about, because I'm sure you get this too, but, you know, people ask me about What the Bleep Do I Know, the movie, right?
Yeah, sure.
And I know I've heard you say that you're not particularly impressed by it, and neither am I, but one of the reasons I'm not is because the person behind it, this Jay-Z Knight, who claims to be channeling Ramtha, who, you know, even if you get past the idea that Ramtha is a Lemurian warrior who fought for Atlantis 35,000 years ago. Even if you get past all that, which may or may not be true, you have to deal with the fact that Rompt is also advising her to buy horses and resell them at a higher price because they're the reincarnation of other horses. But you look at her Rompt, the School of Enlightenment, and do people come through there, and are they transformed, and are their lives improved? I have no doubt that they have genuine experiences, transformational experiences. But we have to say, what does that rest on? And that's where I think science helps us. And I'd say the same thing with Freud. I don't care how many people were cured or transformed. What does it rest on? And if there is no foundation to it, or if it's fraudulent, the foundation to it, then why do we want to carry it around with us?
Well, it's like anything else, Alex. You carry around what works and you let go of what doesn't. I mean, that's how knowledge progresses from generation to generation. And again, I mean, there's a lot in Freud that has played out extremely well. Like, for example, that children have sexualities. I mean, that was pure blasphemy when he was exploring that. But I doubt any, you know, good child psychologist would deny that today. And you know, the sexual roots of religious experience. I mean, that's something that's been played out thousands and thousands and thousands of books by very fine scholars. And it's not that you have to buy. I mean, I think the fallacy here is that you have to buy into the whole system to be inspired by any of it. I just don't see that. I don't understand that. He was Freud, like any thinker, a man of his own time, and he's going to see certain things and not see other things. And you know, we're no different right now. We're seeing certain things and we're not seeing other things. And 100 years from now, people will look back at us and say, well, that was a bunch of bullcrap. And a lot of it is, and some of it's not. And so I think you just have to have faith that by speaking in public, by publishing, by discussing these ideas, that, you know, there'll be a kind of winnowing as the decades roll on. I mean that's my ultimate hope anyway.
Yeah, I kind of hear you, and I think everyone has to stand on their reputation and on the work they produce. But in doing that, I think we also have to kind of call bullshit when we see it, you know, and that's when I see Jay-Z Knight and I say, you know, hey, I can buy into it to a certain extent, but I got to call bull here. And I say the same thing, you know, it just seems to me improper to give a pass to a guy who, by current standards, you know, just wouldn't even be teaching at the junior college down the street because he'd be completely discredited for academic dishonesty. We wouldn't tolerate it now, yet we look back with some kind of fondness. And I don't see, I resist romanticizing that because I see the same problem cropping up when we look at the current crop of paranormal research. I mean, there's some good stuff out there and there's some bad stuff out there. And the only way we can separate the wheat from the chaff is to do the good hard science. And I guess that's where I'm still torn between the science and humanities. I don't know how the humanities helps us in that regard.
Well, I think your total rejection of Freud is a good example of, you know, your commitment to hard science. Because I would never suggest Freud was doing hard science. He was doing what we do in the humanities again. He's reading and interpreting texts, which happen to be dreams or people in this case. And I would argue again that that's a perfectly legitimate and profound thing to do, but not to confuse it with hard science. I hope you didn't catch anything in the book that suggested I was doing science. I'm not doing science. I'm not even interested in doing science because other people can do that very well. So I'm a reader of texts. I'm an interpreter of stories. I'm a scholar of religious traditions, and some kinds of paranormal experiences look to me exactly like traditional religious experiences, and they're coded as stories and they appear as texts. And so I'm basically just saying, hey, we have something to offer here. We can contribute. So I think it's a humble argument. It isn't a a slash and burn argument, and it isn't an unscientific or anti-scientific argument. It's simply a plea to let another voice into the conversation.
Well said. Fair enough. And I think that there's definitely a place at the table for science plus, and that's how I see it. But let's get back to talking about your main area of interest and comparative religions. The other thing you sent me in preparation for this interview is a link to a recently published article that I found very interesting. And I thought I'd just tee that up by asking you to tell us how the world looks from where you sit, going through your experiences in looking at different religious traditions. From your latest piece, you draw out this near versus future when we look at religions, sameness versus differences. Big picture, Jeff, what's the world look like from a comparative religion standpoint?
Well, it looks on one level pretty grim. On another level, the rays of hope. The piece you're referring to, I was asked to write just a short opinion piece on the future of religion by a website called Pathos. And so I did that. And, I basically said, look, that the far future is much easier to guess at than the near future, because in the far future, say 10,000 years out, none of the religions today will exist in their present forms. That's a pretty good guess from what we know about the past. If the future behaves at all like the past, none of the religions will be around. They'll have morphed into something else, or they'll die out. And so I basically say, if you're worshiping a god, you're basically worshiping Zeus, because of course there are no more temples here around Zeus. So that's the first argument. The second argument, though, is that doesn't mean that religion will go away. And that at least in the Western economically stable, educated world, whether it's in the West or Asia, that I think religious belief and religious systems are going to hinge largely on this question we were talking about earlier, about what mind is or what consciousness is. And, if it's established beyond a shadow of a doubt that consciousness is simply brain processes, that we're essentially biological robots, and mind is a kind of extremely elaborate froth of firing neurons, well, that's going to have a devastating effect on the future of religion. But my own guess is that will not be established, because it's not true. So I think there'll be a kind of philosophical or metaphysical base for religious belief, but that doesn't mean the individual belief systems will continue to have the same power over us. Basically what a comparativist sees is that all belief systems are relative to their place and time, and that none of them are completely true, and that they're largely functional. They work for people. They serve certain needs, certain social needs, certain emotional needs, but they're not literally true, like a mathematical statement or something.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that opens up a whole area that we could go into, because I think that area of truth in spiritual experience is something that's also at the core of this. In my view, I think we get closer to that with some of the near-death experience research, as well as some of the medium communication research, deathbed vision research. I don't know. Yeah. I think that gives us hints to what the truth may really be there. And
right. But again, absolutely. But if you look at that research, Alex, what you see is that it often conflicts pretty strongly with traditional religious beliefs. You'll find stuff that will confirm, but you tend to get these one life narratives, these one life near death experiences in the West, and you tend to get these reincarnations or these past life memories in Asia, and there's overlap. It's this fascinating overlap where you get the kid from the Baptist South having a near remembering a previous life or something. Again, I think that that data set is incredibly important, and it certainly suggests that consciousness survives bodily death. I'm happy going there. In fact, that's my guess. That's my belief or my tentative conclusion. But that doesn't support a particular religious worldview. In fact, it directly challenges most of the ones I'm surrounded here down in Texas.
Well, I have to say that's exactly the issue we've explored in this show. And it was interesting, most recently we had an interview with Dr. Gary Habermas from Liberty University, and a very well-known Christian apologist, very nice guy, well-spoken guy. And he wrote a book on near-death experiences that kind of addressed the same point. You know, it's the standard line you hear from the Christian right, the Christian fundamentalist, which is, God, yeah, heaven, yeah. Oh, all that other stuff that's in the same container? No. You know, we can't.
Right.
And it's such an obvious contradiction in logic just to say that we can accept these accounts, but only up to a point, and only to the point where they contradict with our doctrine, and then we can't
that's
anymore.
Right.
And I think it's amazing.
And what I'm saying as a comparativist is not that at all. I am by no means pushing a particular worldview. I'm saying that near-death experiences and memories of past lives are still reflecting cultural beliefs. They're still narratives. They're still embedded in meaning systems that need to be interpreted, and they can't be handled, necessarily literally. That doesn't mean that consciousness doesn't survive bodily death. It means that when consciousness expresses itself, it always expresses itself through culture. And so you need somebody who knows how to study culture in this mix. You can't just be studying brain states. It just doesn't work.
Fair enough. But I think there's two steps here. I mean, I think the first step is crossing this materialistic paradigm where we jump across the chasm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right? And we say, like you just did, hey, by the best we can tell, consciousness seems to survive death. Get over it. We don't know what it means, but just get over it. And then right. I think I'm very excited to dig into the content, do content analysis every which way from Sunday. But I'm not totally understanding what we're missing there. If we dig into that content from the means that we're doing it already,
well, I'm not sure we are missing anything. All I'm doing is highlighting that there are some huge, immensely important philosophical assumptions that are embedded in the data that we need to struggle with, and they're largely, for lack of a better term, theological or even metaphysical. For example, I mean, the near-death literature I've read, and I've read a lot of it. You really do have, in my mind at least, you have this huge question of whether we live once or whether we live many times. And, you know, you can read Ray Moody or some of the best near-death literature and come away thinking we live once and then are, you know, absorbed into the light or something. And then you read Ian Stevenson and you're like, well, geez, I don't know anymore. You know, maybe I'm coming back.
I've never gotten the impression from reading the NDE literature that we live one time. I mean, some don't explicitly talk about reincarnation, but there's plenty of accounts that hint at that in various ways. What are you referring to when you say that kind of one-shot deal?
Well, I think a number of the narratives do imply or assume that when the person dies, that there's not a return into another body or into another life form.
Uh-huh.
I think another big share of the literature assumes and even requires that we do. And so these are the kind of questions that, of course, the religions have debated for millennia. And so what I'm saying again is that the data isn't as clear as we think, and that it lands us right in the middle of profound religious and philosophical debates that have been going on for a long, long time, and that it's useful to know about that.
Absolutely right.
But again, don't mishear me. I don't think you are mishearing me, but I'm not suggesting that near-death experiences are simply culture or nothing but local context. Not at all. I think consciousness is self-existent and does survive bodily death. But I also think it always, always, always expresses itself, at least here in this world we live in, through language and culture and context. And so you're never outside of that. But you may be outside of it when you die. I mean, I don't know. If I've died before, I don't remember it.
Interesting. No, I think that's a point well taken, and I think it's very easy to leave those influences out of our analysis, our take of it.
Well, it's very easy to misunderstand that argument. I mean, this is the argument I make in Chapter 4 of the book with respect to Bertrand Meust's work. I developed this model of consciousness and culture, and I'm sure some people will read that as me just arguing that it's always just culture, and other people will argue that will read it as saying, well, you know, I believe in some kind of absolute consciousness beyond all culture. And, you know, the latter may be more true than the former, but actually it's both. Again, I'm trying to maintain this both and thinking and not keep falling into this either or thinking.
Hey, let me switch only slightly, and I want to play for you a clip from your podcast where you talk about the culture war between science and religion, and I want to chat about that for a minute, okay?
The cultural wars and debates out there between what's usually called science and religion are, again, I think simplistic to the extreme. The religion side is often parodied as the kind of most literalistic and intolerant forms of fundamentalism. And the scientific side is often parodied as the most materialistic and intolerant forms of scientism. So you have pure faith on one side and pure reason on the other, and we're supposed to believe somehow that these two things don't meet in the middle. And I find that completely unconvincing.
Okay, so let's pull that apart, because
that was pretty good.
That's pretty good. You like that guy?
Yeah, I like that guy.
We need to hear more of him, don't we?
Yeah.
Well, you know, my only kind of pullback on that as I was listening to it is, of course, I agree. And at the same time, I'm wondering if you're maybe papering over the divide a little bit. I have to tell you, as someone who started going back to church for the first time in my adult life about a year ago, and I'm still, you know, I have to put air quotes around 90% of what I experienced there.
But, yeah, me too. Me too, Alex. I try to go back and I walk out completely disgusted.
Yeah, well, it's hard. It's hard, but I feel that alternative, in terms of an atheistic worldview and all the influence we get from that, I do feel I need to be conditioned in balance to that. But, you know, when I first started going back, I fully expected to find this kind of open-minded, emergent church Christian that you seem to be alluding to, and I don't know about you, but I didn't. I mean, nice folks, but very, very much in the mindset of literalistic interpretation of Scripture with a couple of papered over liberalisms. And, you know, and I don't live in Houston, Texas. I live in Southern California, and the church we attend is very, you know, liberal Protestant church. I don't really see it. And you know, when you flip over to the other side and Skeptico and talking to academic scientists, I mean, just as willfully ignorant of this stuff, as dogmatically materialistic as you would expect. So I don't know. Are we papering over this divide in the culture war? It seems to me pretty big in a lot of places.
I think there's a spectrum, Alex, and I'm sure everything you just said is absolutely correct. I could tell you some very, very similar stories. I suppose what I was referring when you quoted me there, I really wasn't thinking of the churches per se. I was thinking of this large body of Americans that don't even necessarily associate with a particular church or synagogue or temple, but still consider themselves, you know, this is the I'm spiritual but not religious crowd. And I think they actually are very thoughtful about these things. And I do know there are lots of people in the liberal churches that are very thoughtful too. So I wouldn't give up on the churches and the synagogues and the temples, but I would acknowledge you know, everything you just said. I think the worldviews are largely incompatible. And so when I issue words of hope like that, I'm not so much thinking of returning, which was your language. I have no desire to return to a religious worldview that is essentially dysfunctional now. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking more of creating a new religious worldview, not me personally, mind you, but as a culture. And you know, this is what my work on the Human Potential Movement was largely about in California. There was looking at a group of people and a group of movements that had no intention of going back. Mm-hmm. to dysfunctional religious systems and adored science and wanted to take the best of science and the best of the religious traditions, fuse them into something for the future that we don't even know what it looks like yet. I mean, that's where the historian can speak here too. You know, when religious systems start out, nobody knows where they're going. And they never, ever, ever come out of nowhere. They're always syntheses or fusions of the scientific knowledge of the time and the different cultures that are interacting. And so, you know, where I place my hope isn't on Church A or Synagogue B or Scientist X. It's you know, the future generations who, you know, can put this stuff together in a completely new way, which I think is almost inevitable. It doesn't mean that there won't be a lot of angst and cultural war and even violence. I suspect there will be, as there always has been. But, you know, ultimately people are really interested in the truth, whatever that truth right. is. And I think it actually does win out eventually.
Well, that's really interesting, and that's encouraging. And I wonder if you could flesh out this other idea, which I love that you introduced, and I forget where, but this... The linchpin of consciousness, I think, was the phrase I picked out.
Right.
And that I think that's so apropos, that really consciousness is the linchpin in this culture war. And then I'd add in truth and ask you to mix that in, which I think you already handled. You know, what is the truth about consciousness, and how does that, whatever that truth turn out to be, why is that the linchpin?
Well, it's the linchpin because all human beings who are engaged in these culture wars are at the end of the day, forms of consciousness interacting with one another. And really, I think what's being debated, when you scrape away all of the, you know, the personalities and the books, is really what's being debated is whether a scientific materialism is the final answer to everything, or is there this plus? Is most of the world in fact run by materialistic and mechanical processes, but there's this plus that's involved in the world as well that we can call consciousness or mind, and I think that's really the ultimate debate in here, and unfortunately it gets. The discussion keeps getting sidelined by what are essentially religious ideologies that are not friendly to science. For example, the intelligent design stuff. I mean, you know, it's kind of creationism hiding as something else, and that will never work.
Yeah, but we could argue the same thing about Darwinism. Darwinism is a very loose set of ideas hiding as science, and I don't say that as a creationist or anything like that. I just say that as purely if you look at deconstruction.
Well, that's my point, Alex, is that I think there are some very thoughtful philosophers out there that do think that there's something we might call mind or consciousness that's been involved in the evolutionary process. And when anybody tries to articulate that, you know, the sort of far skeptical left just swings the flag of intelligent design and creationism, and that's not what's being argued at all.
Absolutely, and you know, it's not even you know, the other thing that you're kind of alluding to really is that it's not the far, far left. It's the mainstream science that we're kind of caught in the middle, and that's the idea that I see of this linchpin, and we're caught in the middle of two radical and dominant cultural influence, and one is scientism
right.
and materialism,
right.
which is
right.
dominant. I mean, we cannot get away from it.
Right.
And the other is Christianity, which is just as materialistic. I mean, that's the thing I think people, and you can speak to this, but at the core, it's very much in support of the materialistic idea, you know? I mean, right. Yeah, these miracles, they only happened here and here, these two times as mentioned. All the other stuff, no, that could never happen because it has to be confined
or it's of the
to
devil
our
or something.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Well, this is why, you know, a lot of my work, actually, you know, I use this phrase beyond reason and beyond belief, because I think those are the two poles, this hyper materialistic rationalism that just refuses to see beyond its own assumptions. But on the other side, then this fundamentalism, and neither one of those again are helpful. And I think that's exactly what you were just saying. We're caught in the middle of that.
Not only are they not helpful, but they're not even true or proven in the normal ways that we understand them in science. I mean, you take
and
material.
They behave awfully. They're really nasty behaviors.
Well, you know, the word that pops to mind is what you mentioned before: is humility. And I swear, I've walked into these debates, and it's sent people off the edge, and I didn't intend to, but in talking to Christians or in talking to scientists and say, don't you think you'd at least be a little more humble with your ideas? You know, and you say that to a Christian, and it can really get nasty really quick. Why, humble? Why should we be humble? We're right. And you say that to a scientist, you know, why should we be humble? We're right. You know, so it's certainly refreshing to hear you coming from the humanities. If nothing else, that's the fabulous contribution, is to come and say, from where I sit, our worldview is we need to be humble, you know?
Right. Yeah. Again, but that's my both and proposal, right? They're in an either or mindset. They're in a slash and burn, winner takes all, you know, but I will say, Alex, I will say this, I think the scientist is right to the extent that there are religious worldviews that are completely incompatible with scientific truth.
Right.
And I think that needs to be said. I am by no means proposing a kind of a relativism where any religious worldview should have the same say as any other. That's ridiculous. We simply know things about the world that renders particular religious doctrines silly. And we need to say that. And so, you know, but we say that all the time in the study of religion, but the difference is nobody listens to us. We're just those funny humanities over on the side of campus that we can't get grants, we can't get anything because nobody thinks we know anything. So, you know, when a scientist says it, everybody listens, and what a scientist usually says about religion is often pretty silly. They usually don't know what they're talking about. But when we say something about religion, nobody listens to us because it doesn't matter.
Well, I think you're in the process of changing that. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this fantastic project, Authors of the Impossible, and authors having two different meanings there, and that we're all authors of the impossible, but there's also some very well-informed authors of the impossible. And maybe tell us a little bit about the movie, too, and all the other interesting stuff you have going on there.
Well, the actual book, it treats four what I call authors of the impossible. These are four men over the last 130 years who I think have thought in a very sophisticated way about what is today called psychical or paranormal experiences. And those men are Frederick Myers, who was a classicist at Cambridge in the 1880s, and then in the 1890s he was really one of the main figures of something called the London Society for Psychical Research. And these are the people who pioneered what we today call near-death experience, near-death research. And again, what I'd point out here is they were all humanists. Myers was a classicist, and some of his colleagues were philosophers. And, you know, they were working with scientists too, but they were basically using humanistic methods of textual analysis. The second author is Charles Fort, this wonderful American humorist and writer of Anomalies that died in 1932. And then the third and fourth figures are both very much still alive. One is Jacques Vallée, an astronomer turned computer scientist turned ufologist, who was immortalized in Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, in the French scientist character there, Dr. Lacombe. And then Bertrand Meust, a contemporary sociologist and philosopher from France, who whose works, unfortunately, have never been translated. And so I wanted to write a piece on Bertrand, essentially introducing him to the English-speaking world. He's spent his whole career writing very intelligently about animal magnetism, psychical research, and all things paranormal up to the present day. So that those are the four authors. But actually, what I'm doing there is I'm trying to make this argument that we can move, if we engage this material seriously enough, we can move from a position of the paranormal writing us, in which we're essentially caught in a story or narrative, to an authorization where we can actually begin writing ourselves, as it were, through these kinds of experiences. So I'm making an argument for the textual or creative or literary dimensions of these sorts of experiences. And then we're a local film company named XL Films option that book, so we're making a feature documentary out of it here in Richmond, Texas, and we're in the process of filming that right now.
And where does the documentary seem to be taking you? Because I know those projects kind of take on a life of their own, and it also seems like the podcast is also an offshoot of that. Can you tell us where that's evolving to?
Well, yeah. I mean, eventually it's going to revolve around the four authors, two of whom, are, of course, are historical figures. We'll have to recreate their lives. We've already interviewed Jacques and Bertrand at great length, and we can do their bios and basic thoughts fairly quickly. But we're also interweaving and even beginning with lots of contemporary people and their own experiences. And again, the point of the goal of the documentary is to, again, hit this middle space between what I call the History Channel or Larry King Live effect, which is, you know, you have the experiencer and then you have the professional skeptic, and they just completely cancel each other out and you're left with nothing. And then on the other side, you have, you know, the metaphysical film or the science fiction fantasy, where all of these things are taking seriously, but just incredibly exaggerated. And we're trying to go down the middle and say, you know, there are all these real people out there who have had these experiences and are confused by them, and we're going to try to give them a way of thinking about their own experiences that isn't either or, that is largely about creating meaning and story and about affirming that the human being is actually much greater than we imagined him or her to be. So we're presenting a kind of a much grander view of the human being than we see, I think, in the normal fare here. But not a naive one, not a pre-critical one. We're not doing the what the bleep do we know stuff.
Well, it does sound exciting, and from the little bit that I've seen one clip on YouTube that you've put up. But I also listened.
Oh, you saw the Doug Mensch clip.
I did, and that's very intriguing. But then also I listened to your interview with Dean Radin, which I have to say is the best interview I've heard with Dean Radin. Thoroughly enjoyable, went in some areas that I hadn't heard him talk about before, and just I thought you balancing him out with some of these ideas you're talking about speaks to what we might expect in the film in terms of exploring these topics, both scientifically and maybe more in this narrative form. It's really a very intriguing. It hasn't been done before. It's certainly something for all of us who listen to this show to look forward to.
Yeah. No, Dean's a close colleague, and of course he's a very funny and fantastic interviewee. And we've also interviewed Stephen Browdy, the philosopher who wrote The Gold Leaf Lady. And,
right, another excellent interview, right.
Yeah, and both Steve and Dean will almost certainly be in the film, you know, when we're finished with it. So that's sort of where we're at with that. And then I just finished another book. It's not out. It's going to be in press soon, on the paranormal and popular culture. So it looks at pulp fiction, science fiction, and superhero comics, and tries to tease out some of the paranormal currents there by looking at the real life experiences of the authors and artists. So I'm not focusing on the fantasy itself. I'm going back to the autobiographies and the sort of journals and interviews with the actual artists and authors and listening to their own experiences of this stuff, which are often quite dramatic. And their response to it isn't, again, to go into the laboratory. It's to create art. It's to tell a story. It's to paint. It's to illustrate. And so I'm trying to locate this interface between the paranormal and popular culture.
Fascinating. Well, it's just a really fascinating body of work, and certainly wish you all the best of luck with it. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Alex, it's been a great interview. You're really good at this.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I don't know about that, but we just keep pushing on.
No, you're good. You're good. I really appreciate it. I've done a lot of interviewing. Some of it's been very, very bad. And this is easily on the very top of the other end. So,
thanks again to Dr. Jeff Kripal for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about Dr. Kripal's projects, please visit the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. While you're there, you'll also find links to all our previous shows, an email, Facebook link to me, and a link to our forums. Well, that's going to do it for today. Have several interesting interviews coming up in the near future. I hope you'll stay with me for that. And I hope you'll tell everyone you know about Skeptico so we can build this community of truth seekers. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.